So tonight we're covering Matthew 14. And our first question, we're going to start with Trace. Start with Trace. Who was Herod the Tetrarch? Explain how Herod and his family had a role in the history of Christianity. Pass. Okay. Dennis.
Herod was the Tetrarch, which is the title given one of four rulers over the four districts of Palestine. His territory included the regions of Galilee and Perea. And he was a son of Herod the Great, who we remember ordered the killing of babies 2 years and under in Bethlehem, Matthew 2:16, in an attempt to kill baby Jesus, who he probably understood to be a newborn baby. He was a newborn king. I guess he might have thought that he was going to be a threat to his kingship. Also known as Herod Antipas, and I believe he heard Jesus' case. He was crucified in Luke 23:6-12, and I think he also killed John the Baptist.
Very good. Actually, to that end, I found a simple little chart that kind of explains this. Weird family, frankly. This is one of the strangest families. Arkansas can't even come up with a family quite like the Herods. But I believe you're right. Does anyone else have any? I think Lauren will go with you, and then Bart.
Well, for the second part, what role did they have in history of Christianity? Herod the Great rebuilt the temple and the structures around Jerusalem, so that provided the location. A lot of the early things Christianity took place in Isaiah 2:3, the word of the Lord will go forth from Jerusalem.
Exactly. Mark?
Yeah, it's super fascinating history. Herod the Great came to power because he was an Edomite, so he wasn't technically fully Jewish, but he sided with the Romans during a crucial time, and specifically with Julius Caesar. He became a friend of Julius Caesar, and then when Caesar was assassinated, he negotiated the political upheaval expertly, and he sided with Augustus, Octavian. There's a civil war at the time. The Roman Empire was thrown into great conflict, and Mark Antony and Cleopatra were one side of the civil war, and Herod the Great could have joined their side, but instead he joined with Octavian, and Augustus eventually won, and so Herod the Great retained his position all those years. And so he was a super powerful, as we all know, individual backed by Rome. Rome loved him. And that's why we talked about it when we studied why do all the sons, even Herod, Philip, why do they have the name Herod? It's because this is a backwater location. You know, most Romans had never heard of Israel or Judah, but they probably had heard of Herod. Mm-hmm. Over there somewhere in the outback, there's this guy named Herod who's our friend, and we like him. And so after he died, then Rome decided to divide into the territory up into four. Most of the time, one of the sisters was left out. She actually received, it's a little sexist, they always say it's divided up into three parts, and they name these three, Herod, Archelaus, Antipas, and Philip. But there was a woman that received that territory from the Romans as well. She died fairly quickly on. And so, but the Archelaus was one of the three sons, and he received the province of Judea. Mm-hmm. And around AD 6, Archelaus died, and the province of Judea was then made, or the territory of this son was made a province, and the Romans came in and directly took over. And that's why you have Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate is not related biologically, obviously, to Herod. He was a Roman provincial governor that was sent from Rome to take over. And so the politics is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And as has been pointed out, these individuals, the descendant of this man, weave their way through the entire New Testament. They're found in the book of Acts. Agrippa the First and Agrippa the Second are found in the book of Acts. And it's just endlessly fascinating to know that this family had so much to do with the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't agree more. And particularly, for me, the most interesting person here, there's a lot of interesting people on this chart, but I think it's Herod Agrippa II that strikes me as the most interesting, because once you get to Acts 25 and 26, where Paul's preaching to Agrippa, and he tells him, "Do you believe the prophets? I know you believe the prophets." He tells him basically, "You know the history." And thinking about who Agrippa was, okay, you've got his grandfather that was actively trying to kill Jesus as a baby. You have another one of his descendants that kills John the Baptist and questions Jesus at one of his trials. Then you have his father that kills one of the apostles. And then you get to Agrippa II, and he's saying, "Well, almost you persuade me to be a Christian." And you can just imagine, you know, we say the phrase sometimes, you know, they were probably rolling over in their graves. And I'm sure if they had that ability, they would have been doing such. Because for all the history that this family has had with Christianity, then to get to Herod Agrippa II and to hear the good news of Jesus Christ actually taught to him by the Apostle Paul, and for him to even consider it for a moment, to me is astounding. So there's a lot of interesting history, a lot of politics for those that are interested in that side of historical things. But particularly when you're talking about the intertestamental period between the end of course, the book of Zechariah, the end of the Old Testament, up till the beginning of the book of Matthew, there's a lot of interesting history, things that shaped this particular period of time. So I rambled on long enough. Any other comments on question number one? Okay. Let's go on to question number two. This is going to be for Grant. What does it say of John the Baptist that he was willing to stand up to Herod and condemn his actions? And what lessons can we learn from this display of boldness, verses 2 through 4?
Shows that John the Baptist was not willing to step down to any authority. He realized God was the one that was in control, not these other rulers that man has put in place. So the God's the one who put in place to begin with. John was willing to say, "You know what? You're wrong," which these rulers never hear. They always sit around with people who say, "Oh yes, you are always right. You are the ruler. Everything you said is law." And John's saying, "No."
Mm-hmm.
He says, "No." And so we can learn that we also are in the same position in the sense that we know what God's will is, but that doesn't necessarily say give us the right to just go around and tell everybody what to do. But we do say, here's what God's will is. And mm-hmm. We don't have to necessarily count to set down for when somebody says, "Well, the law says I can do this." Like, well, no, God says this is the way it's supposed to be. And there's plenty of laws that are in effect nowadays that certainly are contrary to what God says. Mm-hmm. And should behave. Mm-hmm. And John says the same thing here. You cannot have your brother's wife. So I guess it gives us the boldness to say, we know what God's will is. We can say, here's what God's word says, and that's what it is.
Yeah, excellent. That's exactly correct. I like the fact, like you said, John wasn't a yes man. And anybody in power, they were catered to a great deal, and John was breaking the rule just in that aspect. You don't say that to a king, but that didn't matter. Anyone else have a comment on question number two? Well, there's a few lessons that I thought of, many of which Grant said. Sin must be called what it is. You know, he didn't try to sugarcoat it. He didn't try to break it down. He didn't try to sidestep the issue. John says it is not lawful for thee to have her. Lesson number two, it doesn't matter who commits the sin, still must be preached against. You know, sometimes, I know for myself at least, there's in my mind, there may be a conflict of interest because we have a verse that tells us in the book of 1 Peter, I believe it is, that tells us that we are to respect authority and we're not to speak evil against authority. John proves here he's not speaking against the ruler, he's speaking against the sin. And regardless of who speaks, of who commits that sin, that's still sin. So maybe you've had that that thought in your mind like I have, but it doesn't matter who commits the sin. Still has to be preached against. Still needs to be called what it is. Number three, John said it directly to Herod. He didn't lay out any hints, nor did he have to be nice or courteous when denouncing sin. He didn't resort to passive-aggressive techniques, as we so often see in today's world, where we just drop little hints that we don't approve of this here, we don't approve of this here. John says, no. Herod, it's not lawful for thee to have her. John preached this truth despite the consequences or who it might affect. He knew what would happen. I can only assume that he did, but he did it anyway because it was the truth and because it needed to be said. John didn't change his mind afterwards or walk back anything that he said. And this is something that bothers me personally. When you have people, if you're wrong, if you say something wrong and you know it's wrong and then you apologize for it, that's one thing. If you say something that is right, but it offends people and then you apologize for saying that, that bothers me. That bugs me. John didn't do that. And even though he knew the consequences, he didn't walk back what he said. He stood by what he said because he wasn't out of character in his preaching. This was not something new to John. He preached to everyone like this. He didn't preach this because it garnered high publicity or specifically harsh on only a certain sin. He preached against all sin this way, and he preached to everyone this way. He was consistent all the way through in how he preached, what he preached, and the method that he preached it in. So those are some things that stand out to me in this account, some lessons that that I take from how John handled this situation. Any other comments on question number two? Okay, let's go to question number three. And this is going to be for Lauren. Why was Herod worried about a risen John the Baptist? Was he feeling guilty? And notice what actions were taken by him that led to his, that is John the Baptist's, death.
Well, it's evident that Herod felt some guilt for the murder of John. He was afraid of some of the powers, of the power that Jesus demonstrated, as we see in verse 2. And he reasoned that if it was John, he would use that mighty power being displayed to avenge his murder. So Herod had divorced his wife and married his brother's wife, who was also his niece. And John pointed this out as against Jewish law, which would have been Leviticus 18:16 or Leviticus 18:6. Both would have talked against this. And this Herod wanted to be the leader of the Jews, and this made devout Jews oppose Herod somewhat and turn against him. So Herod imprisoned John because of his wicked wife and killed him to impress her and his evil friend. So that's why he was afraid.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Any other comments on question number three here? Mark.
Yeah, a couple of points. You know, it's like what you said about Agrippa II earlier, that he did believe, you know, he was close, or at least he was close to believing, close to obeying the gospel. And I suspect that all of these individuals knew the prophets. You know, Herod the Great, of course, had advisors who came in and said, this is when the Messiah is going to be born. And so they were all well-versed in, and they knew, I'm sure they knew Leviticus and so on. But what's even more startling about this situation, and it's a little seedy, frankly, but they were related. Herod Philip, who Herodias was initially married to, was his half-brother. It was a different mother, but the same father. And so, and it turns out that Herodias was also part of the family. She was the daughter of another of the wives. And so Antipas was her uncle. So was Herod Philip. Herod Philip was her uncle too, so it's like an incestuous kind of weird situation going on. So in addition to the, I thought about that as we were studying this, like obviously you're stealing someone's wife, but also at the same time, you know, it's close to incestuous, if not just frankly incestuous situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then he obviously, even though John the Baptist hadn't worked any miracles, he believed in miracles because he thought that Jesus might be a called John the Baptist resurrected. And Warren might have said this, but in Matthew 16, some were saying that Jesus was John the Baptist. So he probably had heard that. As Warren pointed out, his guilty conscience was getting.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Any other comments on this particular question here? As Bart said, once you really start breaking it down, what all's happening here, it's a little bit seedy. And even more disturbing, it talks about Herodias' daughter. There's an ancient translation that says that she did leap in the middle. And many commentators believe that's probably in reference to a belly dance that she's doing here. So there's just all kinds of evil wickedness that's transpiring in this particular event that lead to John's death. So you can only imagine, if you're Herod here, that you would have to be feeling some guilt, realizing the actions that you took, the thoughts that were on your mind when you took them. Plus you have Herodias, who seems to hold a grudge pretty well and pretty good at teaching people how to hold grudges with her daughter. There's all kinds of wickedness that's transpiring in this particular event that leads to John the Baptist's death. And if I were Herod, I'd be a little bit worried. I'd be very concerned about someone who is displaying the power of God that has preached against me, and the possibility of him coming back would certainly terrify me if I was in his shoes. Any other comments on this before we move on? Okay. Got a glare on the clock, but we'll just keep heading on here. This is from Malin. Why is the feeding of the 5,000 so significant that all four gospel accounts record of it happening?
Well, I mean, for one, it was a miracle, and so the power of God. So many people were there to witness that. And they all ate and were full, and still there were 12 basket fulls of leftovers. It says 5,000 men, plus women and children, I believe. That's a lot of people that witnessed it. It would be one thing to hear about it, but to actually be there would be make it more of a memorable experience if you were there, especially to tell that the situation is, of course, it wouldn't be possible without God or Jesus. Certainly meant a lot to be there. I was reading, I think it was Mike Criswell's commentary. He noted that they didn't waste any leftovers. Packed them up, and they were frugal with it. They didn't litter the ground or anything. So.
I noticed that too. Reading his commentary, that's an interesting point I hadn't thought of before. Appreciate you bringing that up. Any other comments on question number four here? Warren.
Smith pointed out that in his commentary, this event marked the high point of Jesus' popularity with the masses. And, after this, he's going to start losing popularity, but here everybody loved him, and 5,000 men, so we're probably in the 20,000 range, wandering around through the wilderness here with him. Kind of what Malin was talking about with the baskets, I noticed in Kaufman's commentary, he had an interesting take on this. He talked about everybody speculates on what was done with the leftovers, 12 baskets, so a lot of people think it went to 12 disciples, but he thinks it should have rightfully gone to the lad, and it would have demonstrated that anybody who gives to Jesus gets much more in return.
I like that. That's an interesting thought. I've heard sermons reference the lad and his whoever packed that lunch for him, whether it was he himself, looking out for him on this long journey. The significance of that. A lot of interesting facts, but I like that. I think that's interesting. Yeah. part?
Yeah, I'll give a third possible interpretation. I think it's recorded in all four accounts because Jesus is assuming the mantle of a greater than Moses. So Moses had predicted that a prophet of God would come, and him you will hear. And so Jesus is showing that he is this new deliverer. And when he feeds the multitudes, it's manna from heaven. And in fact, in John chapter 6, which records the same event, Jesus discusses immediately after the walking on the water, him being the manna, I am the manna from heaven. Mm-hmm. And that's also connected to the walking on the water is connected to the Israelites passing through the Red Sea. They were able to pass through the water in the sense it was dry land, but you know, obviously it's kind of allegorically they're walking on the water. So Jesus is connecting by feeding the multitude and by walking on the water, he's showing that he is that Moses-like deliverer who's come. And then finally the connection with the 12. I don't think, for me, the significance is not who got it or that they were saving it and being frugal. It's the connection with the 12 tribes. Mm-hmm. So Jesus is trying, or the writer is trying to show us through this, that we are to catch the connection that it's the 12 tribes of Israel that are being fed as they were with the manna. But Jesus is going to create new Israel, obviously, in the church, which will have Gentiles. So.
Mm-hmm. I also like that. And kind of connecting what Lauren said about this being the peak of Jesus' popularity, John's account is really important for us to understand why this was the peak, because it's John's account that actually has that discussion, that sermon that Jesus preached saying, I am the bread of life. And as soon as he says that, the Bible says that many of his disciples didn't follow him anymore. When he says, "You shall, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you shall have no life in you." A lot of people try to use that in reference to the communion. It's not talking about the communion. It's talking about belief in Jesus Christ. But after he performs this miracle, John's account says that the people, they're ready to take him and make him a king by force because he's proven that he can heal their sick, and now he's proven that he can give them unlimited resources, basically, of food out of very little. I was thinking to myself, you know, we know that there were 5,000 men. Opinions vary on how large it could have been. There's some that say, well, you know, it probably was maybe just a little over 5,000 because there wouldn't have been many women and children out in the wilderness. I don't tend to think that's true because it's proven time and time again that women and children followed after Jesus in great numbers. So it seems to me that it was a large crowd. And just how much in today's world it would cost to feed a crowd of that many people. I know it's a lot of work when we have the midmost study. I know for you ladies in particular that get all that ready to feed that many people, and we're talking, you know, just a 100 people or so, how much it would cost to feed 5,000. And just kind of picture that in your mind, 5,000 at the very minimum, probably many more than that. Truly an incredible miracle. Any other comments? Lauren?
I think one thing we shouldn't overlook is that it shows the love of Jesus. It says, when Jesus heard it, so this is talking about the death of John the Baptist, he departed there by boat to a deserted place by himself. So he left to be in solitude, but then it said he had compassion mm-hmm. on the multitude. They were seeking healing and food, and mm-hmm. they were seeking what Jesus had to offer, and he made time for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that should never be lost, because seems to be the driving force behind why he would do this miracle. Any other comments? Okay, let's move on. This is going to be for Bart. Question number 5, what are some lessons that we can learn from Jesus walking on the water, Peter walking and sinking, and Jesus calming the storm?
Many sermons have been preached on this. I think it's Bill has a real good sermon on walking on the water. So I was kind of hoping he'd be here to deal with this question. But, you know, kind of along the lines of what we were just talking about, that Jesus, Moses, separated the Red Sea, and they were able to walk through. Jesus, the Egyptians are at their back. A great fear, a great storm is coming down upon the Israelites, and yet Moses leads the people on dry land. They walk through the water. Jesus is saying, whatever storm it is in your life, whatever great distress, whatever anxiety that you're going through, Jesus will calm that storm. You still have to pass through the storm. Obviously, mm-hmm. We still pass through anxieties and fears, and we have to deal with death and sorrow. But Jesus is the answer for us to deal with those. It gives us peace that passes understanding. And so I think that's the major point for me out of this. I also thought of Jonah. Jonah was the apostle to the Gentiles, and he was caught in the midst of a storm, and he was lifted up and cast over the side of the ship, and that's what calmed the storm. Then Jesus was lifted up also by Gentiles, incidentally, Romans, and then he was killed, and that calmed the storm for us. We have redemption through Jesus being the one who has calmed the anger of God the Father.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good. Anyone else on question number 5?
Yeah. I mean, Bart kind of touched on this a little bit, but I think it's also a reassurance to us through all time that I think we've all run into that experience where we have a lot of zeal and we run into a situation without maybe thinking about what kind of pressures we may face or what kind of consequences we may get from that. But that shows us even in the midst of that, we need to know that the Lord is there for us.
That's right.
And He's there to stretch out His hand and help us, no matter how, dire the consequences may seem at that time, but to remain whole.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And to that point, sometimes we give Peter a hard time here because he took his eyes off Jesus and he started to sink. We need to give him some credit, though, because he's the only one that got out of the boat. He's the only one that took that leap, if you will, but that walk of faith on the water. And besides Jesus, he's the only other one to walk on water. Just because he was willing to take that chance for Jesus. And it was only when he stopped looking at Jesus and started looking at the other things that were around him that he began to sink. So there's a lesson in that too. Any other comments briefly before we go on to our last question? Okay. So question number 6, this is going to be for Landon. How did the people of the land of Gennesaret have knowledge of Jesus?
So I think this question is pretty simple. As Warren said, this is Jesus' peak popularity. Mm-hmm. He had 25,000 people come out to see him. So it would be no surprise if someone from Gennesaret had been in Capernaum, which is close by, that's where he spent most of his public ministry, had been in Capernaum and heard him talk and brought it back.
Mm-hmm. That is true, but there's a single person that we can look at, and it's the man that was possessed with legion. In fact, we're told the Gadarenes, the country, this is the same region. Verse 38, man out of whom the devils was departed, besought him that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, return to thine own house and show how great things God hath done unto thee. And he went his way and published throughout the whole city how great things Jesus had done unto him. It came to pass that when Jesus was returned, the people gladly received him, for they were all waiting for him. This is one of my favorite characters in the New Testament, because he wants to go with Jesus, and he would have a story to tell like no one else would. Could have been one of Jesus' apostles, but Jesus tells him, no, you need to stay and right where you are and show the great things that I've done for you, and spread this good news to the people that you're around and that you're talking to. And that's exactly what he did. And when Jesus comes back, they're all right there ready to receive him, waiting for Jesus. Because initially, verse 37, they wanted him out of there. They had great fear. They asked him to depart. when he comes back, because of the efforts of this one individual, he's welcomed in. So, any other comments on question six? No? Okay. I had a lesson on this particular individual. I may dust it off sometime and give it, but for now, that's going to be the end of our study tonight. If there are no further comments or questions...